This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. I'm Parv, and I'm here, as ever, with Alan. How are you doing this week, Alan?
I'm fine, thank you very much. I'm very excited to be on again and to be talking some more topics. So, what have we got today? We've got the first three questions we're going to get through. So, shall I start off as we mean to go on?
Yes, let's hit the mailbag. And fans, please keep on writing in, because we enjoy getting your letters.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
So the first one in the mailbag is, what happened to rugged Ronnie Garvin after his feud with Greg Valentine? I don't remember seeing him much after that. And that's written in from Graham Nelson in Calgary, Alberta. So rugged Ronnie, he had his feud with Greg Valentine that ended at the Royal Rumble in 1990. So what really happened to him in the WWF run after that?
Well, how can we say? I think Ronnie Garvin was getting on in years at this time. And he started to slip, as it were, down the card, and he suffered quite a lot of defeats. First of all, he lost to Earthquake at Madison Square Garden. That was in February. Then he lost again to Earthquake at the Cow Palace. And then he went on in an Dominic DiNucci style tribute act. Where I don't know if you know this, but in the early in the late 70s, early 80s, Dominic DiNucci started tagging with all sorts of random lower card jobber type guys. Yeah. Against established teams. So Ronnie Garvin started tagging with people like Troy Williams, Glenn Ruth, and Major Yates. in a number of losing efforts against Demolition, in which obviously Troy Williams was the one who was pinned. That was on an episode of Challenge. Against, get this, and I find this actually heartbreaking, in a 3-minute match on Challenge, Ronnie Garvin and Glenn Ruth lost to Rhythm and Blues. So, yes, the Greg Valentine feud by August of 1990 was a distant memory for Garvin, as he was now being jobbed out in 3 minutes against Rhythm and Blues. And then he, in one of his last major TV appearances on Superstars, and this was the October the 13th edition, he tagged with Major Yates in a losing effort against the Orient Express. So have you seen that match, Alan, the one against the Orient Express?
I have seen them. It was one that I managed to check out, and it's quite interesting with someone like Ronnie Garvin that how many years previous was he the NWA champion? It was 1987, I believe.
So 3 years before this.
Was this a quicker fall from grace than even Tommy Rich?
Yes, I think it was, because Tommy Rich, even though he slipped down the card in WCW, he was never reduced to the status of tagging with job guys. You know, I mean, Major Yates, I don't think ever had a push in his career, did he? He was a proper job guy.
Yeah, I'd never really come across the name before, so he, you know, totally clueless who he was. So yeah, it was sad to see, but like you pointed out earlier, he was getting on in years. He was born in 1945, so he was by this point in his late 40s. So you're not going to a guy in his late 40s be pushed high up the card unless he's called The Undertaker or Kane nowadays, really, or Big Show, and they're because they're freak kind of athletes or names that have been around and associated with that one single product for years and years. But yeah, Ronnie Garvin, he interesting character, because some of his moves as well weren't over much. No one sold them as impactful. It was like the Garvin Stomp. We saw that, didn't we?
Well, yeah, for example, in that Orient Express match, he manages to get the Garvin Stomp on Tanaka or Sato, I can't remember which one, and it's basically brushed off as a nothing move, you know. So yes, what do you think about that being losing to Rhythm and Blues in 3.5 minutes?
Well, when you're losing to Rhythm and Blues at all, never mind in 3.5 minutes, and you're a former NWA World Champion.
But just the fact that it was Greg Valentine, the guy who he was beating at Royal Rumble earlier in the year, and now, you know, now it's 3 minutes and he's done, you know.
No, it just shows how a career trajectory of two people can go completely different ways. I'm not saying that Greg Valentine had a, you know, a super run after this point at all, but he still had years left in the tank, whereas Ron Garvin, you know, that was him. He went to Smoky Mountain, I believe, after this. But for all intents and purposes, his full-time career was done. His last match was actually in September against Pez Watley. His actually last match for WWF. And after that, he was done with the promotion. So is there anyone else in that time period? I know you mentioned examples previously, but in that time period, of anyone else that was on pay-per-views and winning matches, and then 6-9 months later, you know, at this point, jobbing with jobbers?
Paul, I can't think of anybody who's that extreme. I want to say possibly Hercules. I would have to have a look in more detail, but I'd like to know the trajectory of Hercules after about 89. You know, post DBRC feud Hercules, I want to say, but no. But then he has the Power and Glory run, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, he has the Power and Glory run, and he's at WrestleMania 6 and things in 7 with Power and Glory. So I can't. If there's any listeners out there who can think of a better example of a, not just from a world champion perspective, from a, and I'm not going to talk Virgil here either. I'm not. You're not allowed to use him as an example. I'm just going to say that now. But someone else that was kind of pushed as like a credible threat, be it face or heel, to then tagging with not just jobber to the star types who got the odd win, but people who you'd never really even heard of, and they were tagging them and losing efforts to lower level teams like the Orient Express. I'd like to see if anyone else could come up with anyone else bar Ronnie Garvin.
Yeah, it does seem dramatic, because don't forget he beat Valentine at the Royal Rumble, so it's kind of like, it's bizarre. The one thing I will say is that he does have a really neat little 6-minute match with Mr. Perfect at the SummerSlam Fever show. You know, they did those pre-shows for the pay-per-views?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that is a really nice little AWA Kurt Hennig throwback match, because obviously Garvin throws the chops in, and Perfect, it's one of those rare matches where you see Mr. Perfect actually laying in some of his shots a bit more than he would. So, have you seen that one, Alan?
No, I've not seen that one, but I think that's something I will check out after the show. And we can put that in the show notes for anyone if they want to check it out as well, I'm sure. But yeah, Ronnie Garvin, good career faded like that. But it was interesting to see, like you said, that he did have a run after when people, not a run as such, but he did have more matches after when people assume he was done. So is there anything else you'd like to cover on a good old rugged Ronnie?
No, good question, Graham. Let's get the next one.
Okay, next question is from Johnny Schumacher, who is from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And his question is, Virgil and Tito Santana seem to tag a lot together. What can you tell me about this great team? Well, I don't know if we go as far to say it's a great team there, Parv, but what are your thoughts on Virgil tagging with Tito?
Well, Virgil and Tito as a team date back to 1991, and I looked this up, and they only actually tagged together 10 times. So it seems like they tagged together more than they did, because you'd assume that they'd be together on house shows and things, but they weren't. They first got together when Repo Man was introduced to the World Wrestling Federation. Do you remember this, Alan? This it was around this Tuesday in Texas.
So that would have been after Survivor Series. So that would have been November 91. Do you want to re-jog my memory on that?
Yeah, so basically what happens is that, if you remember, Ted DiBiase and Virgil had been feuding over the $1 million belt. And Virgil basically ended up getting the $1 million belt repossessed. So the Repo Man came in and essentially stole the $1 million belt back for Ted, and this is how DiBiase got the belt back. This is how he was able to give it, for example, to Steve Austin years later in storyline. So that ended up with Virgil having a feud with Repo Man. And at This Tuesday in Texas, it was Repo Man and Ted DiBiase taking on Virgil and El Matador. And they basically were transitioning from a feud. So Virgil started feuding with Repo Man, and DiBiase ended up feuding with Tito. And if you have a look at the house show results at this time, it would be Ted and Tito, and it would be Virgil and Repo Man. So, you know, it was a way of kind of transitioning away from the Ted feud for Virgil and onto something else for DiBiase. Now, all of this happened to be mixed because, of course, well, you all know what will happen shortly after this. DiBiase ended up winning the tag team title with IRS. Mm. And Money Incorporated was born. So basically the Ted Tito program was essentially axed. And I don't really know what happened with the Virgil Repo Man stuff, because I don't know if that ever had a proper blow-off anywhere.
They did have an eight-man at WrestleMania 8. I think it was Virgil, Duggan, whoever, versus Repo, and the Nasties. I haven't got the match in front of me, but there was a time, do you remember when Virgil was wearing that, his face smashed in, or had his nose broken?
Oh, yes, I remember, yes. It was around that time. So anyway, that was the birth of the Tito-Virgil connection. It was over those sorts of issues. But basically, I think what happens is that El Matador was kind of left with not a lot to do after the Ted feud was nixed. And then Virgil isn't left with an awful lot to do for the remainder of 1992. And this is when both guys kind of transition into being jobber to the stars. Virgil more so than Tito, I would say. So El Matador was a kind of brief resurgence for Tito. But Virgil, really, after the Ted feud, has got nothing going on at all. So then what happens is that because both of them are sliding down the card, they then kind of get thrown together in random tags. So, for example, at a TV taping in May 92, they take on the Nasty Boys, who were getting a bit of a push in early 92, and obviously in a losing effort there for Virgil and Tito. Then, every once in a while, Money Incorporated would need some opponents. So at a Cap Center show in September of 92, they take on Money Incorporated. In December of 92, when the Head Shrinkers were back together and causing chaos in the WF, they needed somebody to establish themselves against. So of course they beat El Matador and Virgil. And this is where it gets really sad. They actually won a match against the Beverly Brothers in February of 93. But then, I actually watched this match in preparation. This is, okay, get this, March 1993, Alan.
God.
March 93 now. This is at the Manhattan Center for a Raw taping.
Oh, God. At that time, the Beverly Brothers... on the last legs as well, weren't they?
Yeah.
If I'm going to be perfectly honest, I don't think we saw many appearances from those guys. I think one of them stuck around for a little bit. One of them left and one of them stuck around. I can't remember if it was Enos or not. But this is with the Beverly Brothers. But Virgil and Tito, what do you think in kayfabe land would have been their link? As in, why would they get on?
Well, I think they both... basically had issues with DiBiase.
So do you think it started from that? Do you think they hung out backstage in kayfabe land and they were always looking out for each other?
I think there was kind of some idea that they were really good friends. I watched this promo that they did at the Montreal. It's always those Montreal shows for some reason that you have these random promos. But they were really kind of watching each other's backs, you know. Thrown together by this Repo Man Ted DiBiase connection in 91. But this is where I was going with this, Alan. In March of 93, this is how sad it is for these guys. Money Incorporated defeated El Matador and Virgil at the Manhattan Center. They're still clinging on to the remnants of that random feud from December 91 as late as March 93. I mean, that's all they've got going on. You know,
yeah, but that's a commitment to storylines and following on from things that you don't see nowadays. And so you've got to congratulate them.
I watched that match, and it goes on for a good 10, 15 minutes. And the way they work that match is really interesting, because they keep, even in 93, they keep Ted and Virgil from locking up. So they they tease that, and IRS is basically the buffer between them. And I can't believe that they're still playing that up in March of 93. I mean, it's like Virgil's got so little going on that he's still feeding from the scraps of that feud all those years later, you know?
Well, that's all he's really known for, to be totally honest. Virgil seemed to have a few people watch his back. He had Roddy Piper with someone else that would watch Virgil's back a lot, if you noticed. And also, yeah. I mean, it was Virgil. Finally getting attacked backstage by people, and he just needed some more faces to even the numbers. I'm not too sure. People really didn't like his red and white. Reminds me of a barber's logo tights that he wore.
Yeah, there's some really odd things. Like in 1993, Jim Ross is obviously on commentary by that point, and he's still talking about Virgil as like this youngster, you know, as like, you know, a young guy who's looking for a chance to move up the card type thing. And it's like, you know, he's been around since 1988. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
But if you think about that, put that into context, you'll still hear that odd line about, say, a Dolph Ziggler in 2016, who's been around, you know, for 6-7 years as well. So there's still examples of that even today. But time seemed to... This is maybe a topic, again, I think we could branch this out of the topic. 1987 to 1993 seems light years apart than, say, 2009, 2010, and 2016.
I absolutely agree with that, yeah. If it feels like 87 and 93 are further apart than 06 and 16, I would say, almost.
Yeah. No, and so at the time you would feel, wow, they're still going on about this thing that was 6 years, because it felt so much longer because so many things had happened and so many things change, but so many things hadn't happened in a way, because we're seeing more product now. We're in, you know, so many more throwaway matches. So things were more impactful then than they are now overall, even for these lower card kind of feuds that people had had.
Well, this is the saddest part of the Virgil Tito connection here, Alan. The last TV match, June 1993, at the Huntington Civic Arena, in a losing effort against Rex King and Steve Dahl. Now,
I saw that result and I just thought, is that my tape?
I know, I haven't.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen that match, but that's pretty sad, isn't it?
Well, yeah, to be losing to two guys on TV that weren't being pushed, that's it. You're done, really. And I don't think you saw Santana after that, did you?
I think that's pretty much it for Tito.
But we still get Virgil hanging on into 94.
Well, yes, lots more Virgil. But for whatever reason, that's the end of the run for Tito. Why they're losing to those guys, I don't know, though. I mean,
that was a rib, or it must have been a rib.
Yeah, and I'm just having a look now, and I'm not sure if that actual match made it to TV. This was a big, long TV taping, 21 matches on the same card.
Yeah, that's a long one.
And those matches went out on three different editions of Superstars and WWF Mania.
Wow.
And so there was 21 matches on this card, and Rex King and Steve Dahl against Virgil and Tito was the opener.
Yeah, so it was definitely a warm... Well, that's odd as well, then, if you think about it. If that's the opener on any set of TV tapings to get the crowd going, why would you get two names beating two faces in the opener? So it's got to be a rib, or it's got to be punishment.
I don't know. It's very unusual. I mean, that's...
Because I can't see it being a rib, though, because it was for TV, so they're not going to purposely sabotage TV for a rib, you know, to not get the crowd going. So
I tell you what, if you're one of the 4,000 fans at this particular taping... I'm just having a look. There was a lumberjack match between Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake and Money Incorporated. you've got Doink versus Owen Hart.
When was this? In June 93?
June 93, yeah.
Was this after the King of the Ring? This must have been before it, though.
Yokozuna, Yokozuna is the champion, and he's taking on Jim Duggan. Undertaker versus Giant Gonzalez. The Head Shrinkers versus Kamala and Duggan. Lex Luger versus Randy Savage. Marty Jannetty versus Bastian Booger. Steiner Brothers versus Money Incorporated. I mean, this is a loaded, loaded, loaded show, isn't it?
And what market are they in at the moment for this show, did you say?
This is Huntington, West Virginia. I mean, if you were at that particular TV taping, you got a hell of a lot of bang for your buck that night.
Well, yeah, I mean, the ink match against Hogan and Beefcake was obviously going to be a dark match, but interesting because even though I've got the Graham Cawthorne books, the History of WWF books, which anyone should really check out if they're interested in kind of going back and looking at all these weird anomalies, and also the website, you can check out kind of these results we're talking about, the history of WWE.com. But I did not know that Hogan wrestled after King of the Ring apart from on the foreign tour, so that's quite interesting to me that you kind of dig that up.
There's a couple of really weird results here. Adam Bomb was on that card. That seems very early for Adam Bomb, as were the Smoking Guns. That must be right at the start of their run as well. So
yeah, I would say you pretty much there was quite a crop of new guys that came in around
Men
that
on
time.
A Mission were on the card. I mean, were they even around in 93?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bleed there from Hogan on the same card as Adam Bomb, or Hogan, who, you know, was done from the WWE, for, you know, at that point for years.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to look this up,
just in kind of period.
It's June the 15th, 93, TV taping at Huntington. I mean, I don't know if that is entirely accurate, this card, but assuming that it is accurate, that's a really strange one. That's a really weird... I mean, Undertaker versus Giant Gonzalez is a massive match to have just right in the middle of that card, you know? So, anyway,
yeah,
I think we spent...
So something like a different card.
We spent a long time on that question, Alan. Shall we move on?
Yeah, we should move on. And on finally, on to the third question in this segment. Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Colonel Mustafa. Dear God. I want to know what he did after the big match at SummerSlam 91. I remember he feuded with Sergeant Slaughter and Nikolai Volkov, but not a lot else. And this is from Chad Lee Crisolo in Newark, Connecticut. So, Chad Lee, you really need to look at your tasty wrestlers. Colonel Mustafa, your favourite wrestler.
You can pick him.
Right. So, yeah, you can pick him, that's for sure. So what was Colonel Mustafa doing after that blow-off match made in hell in SummerSlam 91?
Well, there was a little bit of afters with that, because if you remember, Sergeant Slaughter turns babyface a little bit after that. And I want to say that he has an association with Nikolai Volkov, and they kind of form that kind of really weak pro-American alliance. Did you remember that? Nikolai Volkov?
Yeah, I never liked Slaughter after the run where he turned face again, really. And Volkov at this point, I mean, we did see him later on in the WWF in 94 when he had no money.
Yes.
And he had a cent symbol on his tights when he was DiBiase's minion. But even this is quite late as well for Nikolai Volkov. But, you know, that's just such a weak thing. Let's just pair these two guys together and just, like, have them on shows.
And were they targeted? I mean, who makes up their Survivor Series team? Is it the Bushwhackers?
Yeah, I think you're right there, Bushwhackers. It's just such a D team, Survivor Series. It really is. It's
Do they lose? Are they one of those teams? Do they win or lose? I can't remember what happens at that particular Survivor Series.
Is this Survivor Series 91?
I think it would be, 91, yeah. Survivor Series.
Let me just have
a look at that quickly while I give you the story of Colonel Mustafa here. I mean, we were talking last show about Ian Mooney being this strange kind of Waluigi character. I want to say that Colonel Mustafa is a rather ill-conceived character as well, because who are we meant to believe that he is? this is my question to wrestling fans, because I mean, clearly he's Iron Sheik, right?
His promo is, everything is just Iron Sheik.
Yeah, I mean, his look is Iron Sheik, his promo is Iron Sheik. When he's first introduced, Roddy Piper kind of isn't quite on message and basically says it's Iron Sheik. So the commentary team isn't quite clear on whether they should call him Mustafa or Sheiky. Him in his promos himself still says things like Iran number one, even though he's meant to be working for Saddam Hussein. So it's like Sheiky's not on script either. He's meant to be allied with the Iraqis, but he's Iranian, which doesn't work for all sorts of reasons. You know, they were at war a couple of years before this. So it's kind of a little bit bizarre who we're meant to believe that Colonel Mustafa is. He's brought in for this one match at SummerSlam and then is literally just floating around for the best part of a year after this, with not a whole lot to do. And he basically, like so many other guys, transitions to a jobber to the stars.
Yeah, he definitely does. I mean, just getting back to the Survivor Series, we completely got who the team was, but we were there. It was a clean sweep for Team Slaughter. So we've got one team here, Team Slaughter, which was Team Captain Sergeant Slaughter with his best pal Jim Duggan, Kerry Von Erich, and Tito Santana. So we've got a mixed bag of guys not doing a lot then in 91 all together. And they beat, what a team this is, in 91. Colonel Mustafa, the Berserker, Skinner and Hercules with Mr. Fuji and General Adnan. And that was a complete clean sweep for Slaughter's team. And that match went 14 minutes. It wasn't actually it was the shortest 4-on-4 elimination match that was on the show. My God, what a crap team that was. Colonel Mustafa, Berserker, and Hercules. All those guys have in common, those four?
Four guys who just had nothing going on. It's very... I mean, there's something not happening about that entire match. You know, babyface Sergeant Slaughter, who's the new Patriot, isn't happening. Patriot Nikolai Volkov is not happening.
No, it wasn't Nikolai. No, that was the thing. It was Duggan. We're getting Duggan mixed up with Nikolai. Here, I think.
Did Nikolai did turn babyface though, didn't he?
Nikolai, I'm sure he did, because I do remember.
We've got this mixed up. Yes, Nikolai was in 1990. That's right. Yes. Sorry, I forget. Maybe Nikolai was the first kind of lamb to the slaughter, as it were, when Slaughter first turned heel.
Yeah, I think it went that way. I think it was Nikolai was on a team versus Slaughter's Mercenaries in 1990. Again, I could be. I'm only going off memory. I don't have it in front of me. But yeah, it's just nothing going on in this match.
So Colonel Mustafa, he hasn't got a lot going on. General Adnan is still with him. The angle is long gone, and he endures into 1992. And like so many guys, ends up going on the European tour with Dino Bravo. That European tour seemed to just be loaded with guys who didn't have a lot going on. Did Hurt go on that tour, I wonder?
If all those other guys did. But you got to remember, like we said in the previous show, they were all names still that people were familiar with, regardless if they won or not.
So we just heard what Tito Santana was up to in around this time. Well, Colonel Mustafa was a chap that was losing to Tito Santana in 1992, for example. So this is around where Mustafa was on the card. There's another match he has with Tatanka, who was getting a push early in 92, and he loses to him as well. And I think last show we mentioned the match they had with Legion of Doom. There's something else that happens, is that Mustafa is on a lot of matches that are being called by Sean Mooney and Lord Alfred Hayes, and they always take a little dig at his stomach. You know, Hayes always mentions that he's put on a little bit of weight. You know, so I think that there's quite a lot of kind of gentle ribs at staff were around this time as well. So,
no, I think he was probably someone that annoyed quite a lot of people in the locker room, maybe, and it was payback time. But there was a match as well in February 92. Slaughter won a handicap flag match against Adnan and Mustafa. So they were still feuding in, like, gimmicky matches, because Sergeant Slaughter... Basically, it's quoted here in WWE.com. Sergeant Slaughter comes back to America and defends the red, white, and blue against his former allies, General Adnan and Colonel Mustafa. So, my God, they've got the cloth and they're wringing it that dry. You know, it's going to break. Never mind getting any more water out of it.
I'm not sure if there's a guy who has less going on than Colonel Mustafa in 1992. I mean, in fact, you know, you were saying about Garvin. I actually think the Mustafa is quite a good kind of parallel study in a way. But I feel like Mustafa's still got more going on than Garvin. Mustafa in 92 has got more than going on than Garvin in late 90. Because at least he's still got the gimmick and he is clinging on to some sort of storyline, not just tagging with like Major Yates and stuff like this.
Yeah, good old Colonel Mustafa. But I think that was... the last we really saw of Sheiky, really, wasn't it, on a major...
Yeah, he crops up for that gimmick battle royal years later, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. And I think he may have done some stuff, I could be wrong, it's the top of my head. Do you remember the AWF Federation in 94, when they were using, like, Bob Orton Jr. as the champion?
Yes.
He may have been associated with one of those kind of things. But, yeah, it was for all intents and purposes, he was pretty much done after this run. So is there anything else you want to add on that question?
No, not really. I mean, the only other thing I'd say about that is that at one point, for some reason, I watched every single Colonel Mustafa match that there was, just out of morbid curiosity. And one of the things that I'll note is that Mustafa, in any of his jobs, will always do that thing where he kicks out just too late, so that he's not quite putting the guy over.
He's still looking slightly strong. He's the old bastard. He knew what he was doing, even though he doesn't.
He even does it in that match against Legion of Doom that I watched. Against him and Bravo, he still does that kind of kick out and immediately gets up afterwards. So he never looks weak in the job. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I understand that completely. Thank you very much, Chadley. If you write any more questions in, can you maybe pick a better wrestler? more for you than me. I don't mind discussing him, but for you watching him and him being your favourite, I think, you know, you need a new set of eyes.
I thought Dino Bravo was his favourite wrestler.
Well, this is it. I know. I mean, now Mustafa's changing from week to week. I wonder who's going to be next week. I'm trying to think of anyone worse than Mustafa that I can think of off the top of my head now. I can't even think of anyone. So, yeah, we'll move on anyway. I'll just move over to you. So what's coming up next on the show?
Well, we go over now to JT Rosero for the Event Center, and he's going to tell us all about what happened in this week back at some point in the early 90s.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
JT Rosero here with your Event Center for this week's episode of Letters from Kayfabe. Thank you, Parf. Thank you, Alan. And of course, we have a great topic still to come here, looking at Roger's Corner and Victory Corner with Roger DeBoard, the precursor to many of the talk shows that you know on WWF television ever since. And I wanted to take a minute here just to talk about, speaking of TV, this is a very interesting week in wrestling history, because it was around this time in the fall of 1996 when there was a ton of change going on in the WWF. There was the ascension of Steve Austin, an influx of talent from WCW, kind of in a swap with some of the more established talent going to Atlanta, but coming in were a lot of guys that were kind of cast away when Hulk Hogan and his crew came in. And that's, of course, Goldust had come in the year before, Vader had to come in earlier in the year, Mick Foley, a lot of new faces, Brian Pillman, Bret Hart was about to return from a sabbatical. So a lot of change, a lot of the guys that were kind of working the mid-card and upper mid-card of the promotion suddenly shuttled up to the main event scene as things were starting to thin out up top. And also a major shift in the way the promotion aired their television happened around this time, because on 9/22/96, the first episode of Superstars aired on the USA Network. And of course, this was the first episode that moved to a Sunday. It had always been usually generally on Saturdays in syndication. But going forward, it would be airing nationally on USA on Sunday mornings. And it was an interesting time. I think it was around this time they started to realize the overall shift in market had really changed. Syndication, not with the same amount of reach. In the past, it had more reach than cable, but as cable continued to grow in each household, it made a sense to shift everything over to USA. Of course, they were also tired, I think, of preemptions, too. Syndicated episodes often moved around, preempted, whether it was due to sports or other reasons. And with Raw really becoming, the past 3 years, as its flagship show, really made an effort in the fall of 96 to kind of rebrand and do the fall season. They had changes to commentary, the way the show was formatted. And part of that, like I mentioned, was superstars moving to USA. On 9/15, they aired a 10-year anniversary recap hosted by Gorilla Monsoon and Mr. Perfect with a lot of clips over the previous years. And of course, that would be the final episode issued out in syndication. Here's the card on the episode, first one that aired on USA Network. It actually took place the morning of Mind Games in Your House. So they actually had live portions of the show took place in Philadelphia earlier in that day. And on that show, we had Vader defeating Savio Vega with a powerbomb. Barry Windham defeated the Goon. Crush pinned David Haskins. Owen Hart and Davey Boy Smith, the tag team champion, or soon to be tag team champions, I should say, defeated Bob Holly and Alex the Pug Porto. And Mark Mero pinned Louis Marcoli with the Shooting Star Press to close out that episode. So, kind of an interesting time. Syndication was such a big part of wrestling, especially WWF, for many, many years. To see it go away was very interesting. And I think it would linger with various shows, especially into the new year with Shotgun Saturday Night. But for all intents and purposes, syndication no longer a major vehicle for WWF programming. Now, speaking of programming, PTBN has plenty of programming for you available on iTunes, whether it's the PWO PTBN Network, the Place to Be Podcast Network, or PTBN Pop. You can subscribe and rate us on each of those offerings, I should say. Also, follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. And be sure to check out all of our written pieces as well as our podcasts each and every day here at PlayStation.com. So, I'm going to toss it back over to Parv and Alan. Like I said, coming up shortly here tonight, we're talking Rogers Corner, Victory Corner. Next week, we're looking at a very interesting topic, talking about Coliseum home videos and their themed tapes like Super Tape and others. So, I am Just Rosero. I am out. We'll talk to you next week, and throwing it back to Parvin Allen.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Rosero. The Event Center, fascinating as always. And now, we're going to go to our longer topic. Who's our letter from this week?
Well, our letter's from Carl Harris in England. He's not stipulated whereabouts in England. If you want to let me know, Mr. Harris, that would be great, from one Englishman to another. So his question was, were there any talk shows in the WWF before Piper's Pit? Well, there was, wasn't there, Parv? What were the talk shows before Piper's Pit?
Well, the first one is actually going back quite a long way into history, and that is Roger's Corner, which I believe ran for a good year or so, and maybe even either early 83 or late 82, I want to say.
Yeah, that's right. It was it ran for around 18 months, and it ran till, you know, like you said, end of 82, start of 83. And there's a reason why it ended at that point, but we'll start discussing Roger's Corner first. And
all right,
Buddy Rogers, former world champion, the original WWF champion, and he was brought back at this period to host his talk show with him as a face, discussing, you know, with various guests. So firstly, what do you feel about bringing Rogers back on TV to do this segment? What do you think the motivation was?
Well, I mean, we've watched some of this. We've started, I mean, it's just started on another show I do called Titans of Wrestling. We watched this era. And we've got up to this point where Roger's Corner has started. And he really does feel, I would say, completely out of place. Even in the context of 82, 83, you know, late Vince Senior, early Vince Junior type era. You know, you've got guys around, like the guys who are around are Jimmy Snuka, who's just on the, you know, this is the era where Jimmy Snuka is really becoming a very big star. In fact, it's right around the time of that clip that you've probably seen a lot that was so influential to the young Mick Foley.
The dive.
The dive from the cage that you've seen a million times. That was right around this time. And in fact, Buddy Rogers took Jimmy Snuka under his wing because he'd been a villain up until that point. And under the tutelage of Lou Albano, and Rogers wanted to take him from Albano and basically put him on the straight and narrow, make him a fan favorite. And this is actually a lot of the Rogers Corner stuff is bound up with this Jimmy Snuka turning angle. And yeah, there's just something not. You watch those Rogers Corner segments and it just feels like something's not quite happening. His tone isn't quite right for the time. He feels irrelevant in a way. He's way too old. How can I say? I mean, Vince McMahon is probably around his age now, isn't he?
Or even yeah, like, I mean, I think he's... No, Vince is probably older. I think with Buddy Rogers, I think it was the hair. You know, that made him look older than he maybe was, you know, the bleach blonde white hair. But I think he was completely miscast, like you said, as a babyface, even at this age, because Rogers was a great heat-seeking, you know, heel manager he could have been, or he was previously. And I think bringing him in here, it was completely miscast. It didn't work. I didn't think it worked, but it lasted 18 months, so it was obviously Vince liked it, and it was effective for Vince. I don't know, a segment like that, how effective would it be on TV to move a feud along? I think that there's an element that it's important to have something like that. That's why this was the first of many to come. So there's a place for it, and I think it worked to a degree. I think it was just fine-tuning it and getting the right kind of presenter there to kind of lead it.
And it's a little bit going back to last week's show, Alan, the presentational elements, you know. If you look at Roger's Corner, it's so bare. You know, it's just like him sitting on a chair with no background, no branding. It just looks like, I don't know, it just looks rubbish. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have any, there's no image associated with the corner. It is literally just a corner. So I think that's one thing that makes it feel like it's not really happening for some reason. So there's that, but there's also the fact that Rogers himself just doesn't, I don't know, he feels a bit too serious in a way, like for to be, like the tone is off. It doesn't seem very, doesn't feel very WWF, if that makes any sense. Even though he has a long association with him, I feel like time had passed him by.
Oh God, completely, by that point. But it was what it was for that 18 months. Is there anything else you want to add about Rogers Corner?
No. I mean, I kind of feel like they could have done more with it. And I actually wonder if the segment would have worked better, like you said, if he was a heel. If it could have actually been a place where they could have kind of started issues, you know. Maybe if he was a manager who had people, you know, it was a prototype for something that they really did perfect with something like a Piper's Pit or any of the other talk show segments that came later. I don't feel like a lot of incidents happened, you know. There are some really boring ones where basically Bob Backlund comes and has a chat.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And it's like, dry. Oh, it's very, very dry.
So dull, you know.
Yeah, and I think it was never mentioned, you know, moving forward. They never mentioned Rogers Corner. They never acknowledged it again. It was forgotten about, you know, especially when we move forward to the later talk shows like Piper's Pit. But Rogers Corner, it was actually replaced by something called Victory Corner, wasn't it, Parv?
Yes. So, and I think I mentioned this briefly before. WWF magazine, which is still running, I believe, isn't it?
Not in print form anymore, I don't believe. I think it's all gone digital now. I could be wrong. I think there may still be a kids magazine, but I don't think there's a WWF one, WWE one.
Okay, well, I mean, the long running, it did run for many, many years. Like, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, you could still get it in WH Smith's.
Yeah. And newsstands everywhere.
For American fans, WH Smith's is a is a British shop that sells books.
It's a news agent's.
Yeah. But basically, when it first started, it was called Victory WWF Victory Magazine. And I think it launched in late 1983.
The actual magazine started in March 83. Victory Corner itself, the segments started on November the 19th. But a bit of background about Victory Magazine. It was started, as I said, in March 83, was launched with Jeff Walton and Robert DeBoard. Jeff Walton is a former Memphis and California manager called Tux Newman. And Robert DeBoard was also associated with the California LA territory, I believe. The WWF, basically, the motivation behind Victory Magazine was the WWF left the NWA in 83, and the magazine started, really, as Bill Apter started ignoring WWF after the split. So they needed their own magazine, they felt it was important, they had something out there to promote the shows, the stars, everything else. And that then changed into the Victory Corner, or that Victory Corner was there to support the magazine, I think, and it ran only from November the 19th to January the 28th. So tell me a little bit about Victory Corner. Who was the presenter and what was it like?
Well, Roger DeBoard, as you mentioned, was the presenter, and how can I read? He was a very straight, dry character, I think. Well, it's serious, not a lot of colour. It was kind of more journalistic, I want to say.
Yeah, I would think that's fair. He was so dry, though, in a charisma black hole. Real, really bad. Total misfit. I know we talked about Rogers before being a misfit, but this was as bad as, if not worse.
Yes. And, I mean, there's not really a lot to write home about with the Victory Corner. It's there's one really memorable interview with in fact there's two I'd point to look out for, in fact three, sorry. Okay, first of all, there's one where Iron Sheik gives a promo as the champion, which is memorable just because Iron Sheik is always fun to watch. But I would say that would probably be like the height of Iron Sheik's overness as a WWF character, at least.
Yeah, that or the Persian clubs.
Another one I would point to would be Roddy Piper, who basically comes in and takes over and declares it, you know, Roddy Piper's Corner, or even like Piper's Piss, I think he calls
it. Well, do you know why that is? Do you want to know the full explanation? Oh, it's not a big story. The explanation for how it moved to Piper's Pit was that Victory Magazine would be renamed WWF Magazine, and that Piper was going to have a monthly article called Piper's Pit, and a new weekly segment under the same name. So that was the kind of storyline transition away from the Victory Corner, and the relaunch of Victory Magazine to WWF Magazine, which is quite interesting.
That is fascinating. So Piper's Pit was originally a magazine tie-in.
Yeah, that's exactly where it came from.
That is fascinating. Well, like I say, I mean, apart from those, because obviously Piper is always good value, Sheik is a lot of fun to watch because of his mangled English and his, you know, he's just insane, isn't he? A lot of the other segments are really dull. I mean, there's one with Gorilla Monsoon. I mean, it's only 2 minutes, but it feels like it's 10 minutes. And it's really, I think Monsoon was doing like a kind of ref enforcer thing around that time, where he was like, I don't know, a special consultant for referees. Are really boring. There's one with Hulk, which is basically just an early Hulk Hogan promo. One of the ones that is interesting to watch from a kind of 2016 perspective is one where Vince McMahon gives this short interview, New Year's Eve, 1983.
No, this is amazing, I think, this one. I mean, I know we spoke about the others. This is the one that stands out to me.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Why didn't you tell people about it?
Well, basically, he's just foreshadowing what's going to happen. He's talking what's going to happen moving into the new year. And it's basically a warning shot, if you read between the lines, to all promoters that Vince is coming for you and he's going to take your business and take your territory. Basically, he's saying there's a lot of stars that are coming to the WWF that you've never seen before. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be different. And it's basically that, isn't it? It's in a way, a very subtle declaration of I'm coming for you.
I mean, his exact words are, I think that 1984 is going to be one of the most turbulent years that the wrestling business has ever seen. Something along those lines, he says, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's right. And it's eerie in a way, looking that that's, you know, looking back now in hindsight, what he was saying and what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically Vince putting himself over. You know, I mean, do you think the other promoters would have seen this? If they were awake, the warning signs would have been there. And it's interesting what you said about the LA territory, Alan, because, you know, LA was the first purchase for Vince. And I think he already had it by this time. They'd already started running LA in 1983. So it was the first expansion was into that old LaBelle territory.
Well, that would kind of tie in then with Robert DeBoard and Jeff Walton doing.
Yeah, and I believe LaBelle was on the payroll as well. The second one that they would acquire soon after this was St. Louis. That would be Larry Matisic selling out, and that's when they acquired the Wrestling at the Chase TV show. And I think Hogan's very first title defense takes place in St. Louis. And then it's not long after that that he starts really invading the AWA talent. You know, Mean Gene,
Schultz.
Bobby the Brain. You know, it's 84 where he really lays into Vern. And there's the warning shot right there in December 1983.
Yeah, and I think if we had more of a fanzine magazine culture, I know there was still a newsletter culture around that time, you know, this may have been picked up on by all the promoters. So I don't know at the time how this was reported in the kind of niche newsletter, you know, circles. But, you know, anyone with half a brain who knew Vince was the running, you know, the owner of WWF at this point, that, you know, alarm bells would be ringing. So it's anyone should check that out. It's a very, very 2 minute clip.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. And we've opened another dark little corner, excuse the pun, of the WWF universe.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yes, join us next week for more fabulous mailbag action. Alan, where can people get hold of us if they want to send in their own questions?
Well, apart from via smoke signals or carrier pigeon, the best way to actually get hold of me would be on Twitter. And my handle or name or whatever you call it is Alan_Cheapshot. That's spelled Alan_Cheapshot. So you can hit me up on there. And how do we get hold of you and the show itself, Parv?
Well, you can get hold of me on @JerryVonK on Twitter. You can also join us on Facebook. Just search out the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, and you can leave a message in there. You can try to get in touch via email on the Place to Be Nation website, although that method is not recommended if you actually want your questions read out. You know, the likes of Chadley Criscolo have worked out how to get in touch with us, so you should do that also. So join us next time for Letters from Kayfabe.
Adios.
Thank you very much, and welcome to Victory's Corner. This week we're honored to have with us the voice of professional wrestling, Vince McMahon. Vince, a lot of our readers want to know, because of how close you are to professional wrestling, tell us a little bit about what you see coming up, who you see what titles you might see changing hands.
Again, from an announcer standpoint, I must say from a fan standpoint, because I consider myself one of the greatest wrestling fans ever as far as interest in professional wrestling is concerned, I see 1984 as being perhaps the most turbulent year in professional wrestling. I think that with the recent happenings that we have seen as of late, it would point toward a direction of a lot of turbulence, a lot of unusual things happening in professional wrestling, and it would probably open the gates for a virtual flood of wrestling talent into the World Wrestling Federation, the likes of which we've never seen before. I think that many things would point to an indication that indeed the possibility of the turbulence that I mentioned would certainly be forthcoming.